So this is recording. Okay, this is June 22nd, 2005. My name is Charles Rust, and I'm interviewing Orville McCarver for the MSU Billings Oral History Project, and I'm interviewing Mr. McCarver in his home in Three Forks, Montana. So I know you're not a native of Montana, so why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and some of the things you were doing prior to your induction into World War II, into the military in World War II?
Charlie, I was brought up on a family farm near McCrae, Arkansas. We grew cotton, corn. My folks had grown a lot of strawberries. In fact, we had 10 acres one year. I remember how tired my back got from what we call whipping strawberry plants. But my folks actually went broke on strawberries. My father, back in 28 and during the Depression, shipped berries to the fresh fruit market in St. Louis and other places, got no returns whatsoever. And there's times he got returns for less than it cost to pick and pack them, a crate of 24 quarts. In 1935, when I was 10 years old, my father informed my brother and I, one of my brothers, that we don't own this place any longer. There's 160 belonged to my grandfather and grandmother who came down from Illinois in the early part of the century in 1911 and settled there. We were about a mile and a half from town, but anyway, he informed us we didn't own this place any longer, my father. And soon I found out we didn't own the horses or the cows or anything else. So 5 years later, in 1940, my father passed away at the age of 38. That left my mother with five sons, the oldest being 16. I was number two, 15, and on down to the youngest brother was, he was 11, and my sister was a caboose. She was 4 years old.
No,
I didn't realize what happened, but anyway, we stayed on this rented farm of 40 acres, and we farmed it, but we also rented other land, grew some pretty good crops of corn, peanuts, cotton. We didn't go back to strawberries.
A little easier raising peanuts and corn than strawberries, wasn't it?
Yes. Strawberries, you can't sell them in a day or two, right? They're gone.
When did this was in 1940, so this was getting close to the start of World War II then,
That is true. In fact, my father expressed with five sons, he many times expressed fear of what could happen.
Right.
And, well, let's see, in 1942, I took out and went to school, to a summer school, and worked too in town. And then in the fall,
you were going to college in town then in 42?
Yes, in I finished my high school.
Finished your high school?
College Academy.
College Academy, okay.
And then, early September, I went to work for what they call the War Emergency Pipelines. Mm-hmm. It was a big inch pipeline known as 24 inch in diameter steel. Started in Longview, Texas, and went to the Eastern Seaboard and at Fort in Eastern Pennsylvania, as I remember. And my job was going through that pipe, about a joint, one joint at a time, the average being 40 feet long. Mm-hmm. I swabbed out, used a swab and swabbed out the slag and foreign matter that got in there in the handling, sometimes gravel, sometimes machine slivers of steel. But anyway, I went through about, close to 60 miles of it in Arkansas.
Oh boy.
My face would be purple.
I got through in the
10-hour day. We got 50 cents an hour and thought that was wonderful. I worked first near home, near my county seat, Searcy, Arkansas. And then they moved us down to Philadelphia, Arkansas, in the south west corner of the state. And there we did a section, did a segment, southern Arkansas, about 30 miles, and we stopped at the Ouachita River. Then they moved us to Pennsylvania. It took some doings, but I got my mother to permit that I go to Pennsylvania. I was 17. We went to Lancaster. Oh, that was a great for me. It was different. There were tall buildings, city life, which I was not used to at all. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the people. I enjoyed the Amish tribes who were agrarian. And I took my wife Helen back there when I'd been away from there exactly 60 years. I took her to Lancaster, and I believe that she enjoyed the 2 days we spent in Lancaster County more than any place I ever took her. And I took her to quite a few places.
That's an interesting stop, isn't it?
Well, we moved. We got done in Lancaster. We stopped at the Susquehanna River, and they moved us down to Uniontown, southwestern Montana.
Take a minute. You were 17 years old at that time, and what were your feelings about the war that was happening, got underway about then? What was your attitude? Were you upset or scared? Or
there was
concerned?
Someone who told me and says, you're going to be in it. Don't worry, and I was.
But then you moved, go ahead then, you moved to southwest Montana.
That's right, we were southwest Pennsylvania.
Southwest Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm.
And we were in Uniontown, a coal miner's town. Mm-hmm. I get about two blocks down the street with a clean shirt and then the coal dust and the smoke. But I enjoyed it there.
Weren't any environmental laws on about coal dust at that time, was there?
Oh, no. That would make an environmentalist turn gray overnight.
Yes.
At this day and time. Uh-huh. Anyway, I wasn't in Uniontown, but about 10 days or so until I got the draft notice through mail from Arkansas. I'd been promised that it would come to Pennsylvania, my Pennsylvania mailing address, mm-hmm. to my company. And Well, it didn't, and that, there it was, my mother had to do it up and send it back to me. And that took up all the time I had.
Oh, gosh.
And I was late going to the induction center in Little Rock.
Oh, boy.
I was fortunate to get a ride over to Connellsville and then to Pittsburgh. And then took a train to St. Louis. And from St. Louis, I took a bus to my county seat. But my bus had already left for Little Rock with other inductees, the other recruits. Well, I got them to give me a ticket, and I got on the next bus. Mm-hmm. I explained to them how I was late, and the sergeant started looking at me cross-eyed, and finally he said, well, get your clothes off and get in that line over there. I was in Little Rock then, at the Donaghy, what's known as the old Donaghy building. There I was sworn into the Navy. And
did you have a choice of the military branch, or did they just induct you into the Navy?
Well, they said they'd rather I take the Navy.
Yeah, okay.
They usually give you a choice, but the Navy begs, you know that, but yeah. Sometimes they have to deviate, I think. They did with me.
Yeah, at that time, yeah, I suppose.
And I got a week at home. I hadn't been home for about 10 months. So I went home and got to spend a week with my family, my mother, my grandma who lived with us, and my four brothers, and my sister and neighbors. And then they put me on a troop train and shipped me to San Diego. There, of course, I went through all the training, the boot camp. They said I would be 12 weeks training.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they kept cutting it back. And we had to cut out this and that. And I was only, I believe it was 9 weeks, or either 8, I'm not sure, in the boot camp. We were only 3 weeks in detention. And then they put me in a school, what they call a gunnery school, down at the destroyer base in the San Diego area. We were taught all about guns. When the war broke out, every ship that went to sea, they wanted it armed. And they proceeded to train the merchant marines, but it didn't work out. So they changed it, and the Navy put guns on every ship that went out. They put on anti-aircraft guns, they put on 20 millimeters, they put on the 3-inch 50. Put in a 4-inch 50, 6-inch surface guns, and so forth. They put guns on all ships, and they called it the Armed Guard. My home base was at Treasure Island in San Francisco Bay, also known as, part of it known as Goat Island. And Goat Island is a natural island, and they attached 400 acres to it, dredged up the mud out of the bottom of the ocean, and built Treasure Island. And there, I went for training. I did break out with appendicitis there, or at least they said I had it. And they took my appendix out. And then I went aboard a ship called the William Sharon. It was a SS William Sharon, it was called, a steamship. It was
a freight ship, a merchant marine ship?
It was a merchant marine ship,
mm-hmm.
but we were Navy.
Mm-hmm.
29 of us. One gunnery officer, and so we had our ammunition, we got, took our meals at a mess hall on the ship. In October of 1943, we sailed. We got on a brand new ship called the William Sharon, came out of the Kaiser shipyards. At that time, you could just about set your clock there in the Golden Gate Bridge by 8 minutes. The ship would come under that bridge going out to sea. One of the new ones. They sank most of the old ones. Not all, pretty much. Well, as I believe, around October the 8th, we set sail and went straight down to the New Hebrides Island in the Southwest Pacific. We were right at 30 days getting there.
It was a slow ship.
Pardon?
It was a slow ship.
12 knots is all it could do, as I remember. I think that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, they have them 24
more.
I was signed to a 3-inch 50 gun, but not long. I was put on a 20 millimeter, a cannon, small cannon. The bullet, the projector was about 3/4 of an inch. And then, let's see, I was moved to the bridge. A gun on the bridge. There are 4 20 millimeters on the bridge. I had the forward port, that means left side gun, 20 millimeter. And I had that. We went down to the New Hebrides. We were a week, they were a week unloading it, the ship with war equipment. We turned around and came right back to the States, about 30 days. We got home just before Christmas. I still couldn't get a leave. I thought maybe I'd get a leave, but no way. And so they reloaded the ship, and it's about the second week in January of 44, we sailed again and went to Melanie Bay, New Guinea. I can't remember the native name for that now. It was in southern British New Guinea. And we did a lot of running up and down the coast of New Guinea. We were at Oro Bay. We were at the French Haven, Buna. I had a chance to get to what they call Goodenough Island. And from that, I did have to go get the ship's mail. Another fellow and I, and we ended up flying over to Port Moresby. That's on the west side of New Guinea, real close to Australia. That was about the only town in New Guinea that was really civilized or modern, like one of a modern town in Australia or, mm-hmm. or here. There 2 days, and they flew us back over the volcano, over New Guinea, and back to Oro Bay, and we got a ride back to our ship.
How often did you get mail when you were at sea aboard ship? Did it?
Oh, once a month.
Once
sometimes
a month
it was
mail.
A little more, sometimes it was less.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
About that. Okay.
They did a good job there of taking care of us. Yes, sir. Well, let's see. Well, I was, that trip back to New Guinea, before we left for New Guinea, before we left San Francisco, I found out that my mother had married, remarried, a fellow I knew well, and I thought, well, but I couldn't go home. And then, let's see, we went up to Hollandia, Dutch New Guinea. And then above Hollandia was a little place called Sadar, S-A-D-A-R. And we were in some air raids there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's some of the first action I saw. In that little bay there, there were three ships just like ours. And we could hear Madame Tojo at night, in the evening. And she told all about those ships, gave the names of them and what we were carrying, what was being carried on them, cargo.
And she had been told you what the cargo was as well as the name of the ship.
She knew. Well, there was that island there, or that Sadar area, was full of prisoners, Japanese. Well, they were Japanese soldiers, but they lost. They lost command. They were just free, trying to stay alive on the island. But anyway,
she came out and told you everything about
yourself.
She sure
did. Of course, they could see everything.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get to go ashore there. I did a lot of places. I got to go ashore, Bougainville. Got to go ashore, and the Japanese were still fighting there. Mm-hmm. As I said, there's several places along the west coast of New Guinea, Good Enough Island, Bougainville Island, New Britain. I enjoyed it very much. I enjoyed the banana plants that grew there native.
Mm-hmm.
And it was coconuts galore, except where we bombarded. There's some of the islands we bombarded the dickens out of them and blew the trees into splinters, the coconut trees. I understand they were owned by Palmolive Peak Company in England.
Was that right?
But
before the war.
But they were replanted, I guess. I hope so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this time my ship, we went to Cairns, Australia twice, to Townsville once, and to Brisbane twice. Brisbane, Australia,
mm-hmm.
and Queensland.
Yeah, okay.
And we were there in the fall of 44. We got to come home, but they took us to Brisbane first, and we took on about 12,000 tons of ammunition.
Oh my God.
That went back to the States, and before we got back to the States, two boiler cubes blew out on our ship. We had only one left, and that got us into American Samoa, a very beautiful island, more like the South Sea Islands you've read about. We were there several days and then proceeded on, and they took us on to San Francisco Bay for a weekend, but that time Port Chicago had blown up. Is one of the biggest blasts of the war. President Roosevelt was out there, looked it over. It blew out pier after pier over at Port Chicago, a little town on the east side of the Bay Area there. pretty close to Pittsburgh, California. Mm-hmm. And of course it killed lots of people, and there was no place for us to go with that ammunition. See, that was an ammunition depot.
Okay.
They claimed somebody dropped a piece of ammunition and it exploded, and that's like throwing a grass, a lip match in a grass patch.
Yeah.
Well, they sent us then up to Canada. We went to Prince Rupert, Canada. It was cold going up that coast.
After being in the South Pacific.
Yes. And we got outside of the Prince Rupert River, the town of Prince Rupert, which is a very beautiful place. And we were in fog, and our radio went out. So we sat there for 3 days in the fog, and blowing the horn, hoping nobody would run into us. And finally the fog lifted, and there were fishing boats, Canadian fishing boats galore, around us, out there, out from us. We signaled one over, and they got on their radio and got into port. And so the port director sent a pilot out, and he took us up the Skeena River, I believe it was. I woke up at 4 o'clock to go and watch. I looked out the portal, and I could see hemlock boughs. That's all I could see, and cedar boughs. It was in a river that wasn't a bit too wide for that ship. In fact, it looked like it was going through the woods.
We'll be damned, just like
on land.
Just like on the trail through the woods. Huh?
And we got there to Port Howard. There were two canneries up there, two fish canneries, and the Port Howard was a village, mostly an Indian village.
There's an Indian village up there,
and then we unloaded. We were quite a while, and then they sent us back to Prince Rupert. But in the meantime, we got permission to go with an Army recreation crew 60 miles north of Fort Howard. The road was partially in up there, and go fishing.
Oh, gosh.
And the steelhead trout, that road was the only thing up there. There's a footbridge where the pack mules went across. We were 60 miles up there. And I was standing on this small bridge, and the water was clear. You could see every fish sitting in there. Oh, old steelhead trouts, just like they were dead. And once one would get a flash from a spoon, and he'd make a dart for it, we caught 8 of them.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't catch any.
But
on that bridge, I could see the water was very clear under me. And one of the soldiers said, "How deep do you think that water is?" I said, "I don't know. I suppose 5 or 6 feet deep."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "No." He said, "That water under you is 18 feet deep." That's how pure it was, how clear,
how clear it was. How it came right up to you.
Right.
Fantastic.
Well, that day after Sunday, we went back to Prince Rupert. We did go to Prince Rupert, and our ship was on its way. It was coming from Port Howard back to Prince Rupert.
Mm-hmm.
At about dark, while we heard the whistle. And so we got back on our ship. We came to Tacoma, Washington, and I spent a considerable time on Liberty in that area, taught Tacoma and Seattle, enjoyed it very much. We got a 17-day pass, and then they canceled it, and then they gave it back to us
for
as the first leave I had.
You'd been in 2 years.
Pardon?
And you'd been in the Navy 2 years by that time.
At that point, no, about a year.
A year and a half, maybe.
A year and a half, probably. So, I got a train and went through Cheyenne, went through Pocatello, Cheyenne, Osawatomie, Kansas, and Kansas, and on into Arkansas, where I spent the time with my family and relatives, which I enjoyed. But the ship that I got off of, the old William Serum, they loaded it up and sent it back, and they wanted to go in a place, put it in a place where they get in fast and get out. So they took it down in the Philippine area, the Philippines. And it got hit twice with a suicide bomber.
Oh my God.
16 men got killed. I knew most of them. The skipper got killed, the chief engineer, the head radio operator, the gunnery officer, who would have been over me if I'd been on it, Lieutenant Ernst. Maybe there's an Ernst in this somewhere.
No, it's all right. No, you're doing fine.
The way it was spelled, too.
Yeah, Ernst.
Just like that.
Ernst, well, we got some people by the name of Ernst in Central Montana.
Yeah. And then the third mate survived it. He managed to get the ship up some way and got it into port. He was a hero. And then since then, the William Sharon, the crew, a different crew, again were considered heroic. But the armed guard of the Navy, the Naval Armed Guard, whatever you want to call it, they had a base, two on the East Coast. They had one at Memphis and one at Treasure Island. And when I found out about 5 years ago that my unit, the Armed Guard, had more casualties than any unit in the military service.
Is that right?
That included the Navy and the Army and the Coast Guard we had nothing to protect us. We were out there on open deck, manning those guns, and so we had a greater loss, more casualties, than any other branch of the military service. And a lot of merchant marines were lost. They were down, the engineers' crews were down in down at the bottom of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when it was torpedoed, no way they could get out.
They're done.
I've got a film on that.
Mm-hmm.
But I found out through, I don't remember where I got the information, but I met another armed guard man who was there before I was. He went over the side of two ships and was lost. And some foreign country in Africa took him in, and they finally got him on the way home.
Mm-hmm.
He lived in Concord, California, a neighbor to my son. And he didn't tell me that we were the greatest losers, but he gave him authentic literature that said so.
Uh-huh.
And
well, because you were all on merchant ships, and there were so many of those, and so many of those were sunk.
Right.
And like you say, you were exposed.
Look at that Mermaid Scrum.
Pardon?
Look at the Mermaid Scrum. Did you ever
read up the Murmansk, where they took over. Oh, that was terrible. Wouldn't that have been awful to have been on them?
No.
Mermansk?
Nobody
up there. No, and it was cold up there.
Cold.
No,
4 minutes you left.
That's right. They just didn't have a chance.
No, fall, they wouldn't give up.
Yeah.
Working on the Allied military government.
Yeah.
And Churchill and Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Just to please them, they'd do it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well,
anyway.
That was a That was an awful run, that one, going up there.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of people on that one.
And then when some ships did get through, the Russians told us that, you can't stay here.
So no.
Once the ship's unloaded, you got to pull out right away.
Mm-hmm. Leave town. Well, then, okay. Well, go ahead then. Well, what ship did you go on? Then your ship got sunk. You got home from, you went on leave, and then when you got back, where were you assigned to then?
They assigned me to a new ship when I went back to Treasure Island called the SS Rainbow.
Oh, hey, what a good name, huh?
It was owned by the American President Lines.
Hmm.
And it was called a C-2, a type.
Mm-hmm.
And they, we went back. It was loaded up, and we went back to the Marshalls, the Gilberts, the Watchaleen Islands,
mm-hmm.
in that area, in that archipelago. In fact, we were down in that area where later they tested the atomic
bomb. That's where they tested the atomic bomb later on. That's right, down in the archipelago. That's, I forgot about that.
I enjoyed that very much. The islands were not big, and a lot of them were made of coral. I remember we went to one and stayed there a few days called Majuro. It was horseshoe shaped,
mm-hmm.
and the reef sticking up above the water a few feet.
Uh-huh.
Turtles big as about a wash tub, huge ones.
Mm-hmm.
We moved around quite a bit in the Marshalls and the Gilberts and Kowatchalines. And
but are we unloading and picking up supplies?
That's right.
And
we were shuttle running.
You were doing shuttle work.
That's right. We were. I was 7 months on that ship. We, after a while, we came back to the States. We stopped in Hawaii, going back for both, coming and going. But other than that, we went right back to the States. We were there a month, and I refurbished my part of it, made sure we had adequate ammunition and that our boat was full. Oh, while we were down there in the Gilberts, one morning I got off watch and I went to the scuttlebutt, that's a drinking fountain, and I was having a drink of cold water, and all of a sudden it came right up in my face, and we stopped dead still.
Mm-hmm.
And our ship got out of lane, some way or other, and ran into a reef and grounded. So we were there for almost 24 hours. We had to wait till the tide came up to pull it off of the reef. But it didn't knock a hole in it. It made a bad crease, just like taking a claw hammer and hitting the side of a tin can. You know what kind of dent you make?
Break it.
So we don't know whatever happened there. There was a lane of boilers, and we were supposed to stay in that lane.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason or other, we didn't. And
somebody's head got rolled for that,
right.
Huh?
The skipper, that was his second one to put on the rock.
Oh, gee.
And he had a scar here,
mm-hmm.
and they claimed that that was the first ship he had a pistol, and he decided to change his mind all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Went out here.
Now,
but I don't know.
Yeah. Well, most of her good story, anyway.
Uh-huh. And then,
down the knee.
Well, they took me, we were about ready to sail on the second voyage on the SS Rainbow, and here came a truck and said, I know you hate to do this, but so they want you over to the base. So everybody has to take that second course on all gunner's mates on a gunnery school. Well, I did. It lasted 3 weeks, and then I went into a specialist school called the 5-inch 38 anti-aircraft gun. Well, then I was through with that, and I had my shots, and I was sleeping over in the lounge one afternoon when somebody woke me up and said, "Aren't you a 5-inch 38 specialist?" I said, "Yes." Said, "You had your shots? Yes. You have this, that? Yes. Come on, you're on draft."
Ooh.
So we went aboard out to Port Chicago, and we went aboard the SS Belgium Victor. It was one of the later ships that was made by the Kaiser Shipyards. And it was not its maiden voyage. It had been to sea before. Mm-hmm. And so I was the captain of their 5-inch 38 and the aircraft gun. And I had a pretty good schooling on it. And they first took us to a little island called, well, first we stopped briefly at Hawaii, and then went on down the Southwest Pacific to a little place called Ulithia, U-T-H-I-L-I-A. We were there only one night, and then they sent us on over to the Marshall Islands, or not the Marshall Islands, but the Leyte Gulf in the Philippines. And we sat there as an ammunition ship. We were not, but there was, that was like a store. It was like a drugstore sort of fountain, so far as ammunition was concerned.
They just came in and you dealt it out, huh?
One guy brought a load over, one ship would unload it, and another one come and pick it up, or pick up something else. That went on for 4 months.
Mm.
And then we were sitting there on the hook in Leyte Gulf. There I saw Admiral Nimitz and I saw Admiral Halsey.
Oh boy, that too. Gosh.
We were over there when the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw such lighting in my life as in that harbor, the Leyte Gulf, and the land around it, about a half circle around us, where the flares and lights celebrating the end of the war.
Oh, is that right? And did you fire their guns and so forth too? And well,
no, we didn't do that.
Didn't do that, huh?
No. Mm-hmm. It wasn't long till they put on about, 12,000 tons of ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
And we headed for the States. We went to Port Chicago, and there it was unloaded. There wasn't much guidance, or when we got back there, the war was over, nobody seemed to care. We had Liberty out of 3 nights, 2 of them we had Liberty. We had to be on board 8 hours off.
Mm-hmm.
The third day. Well, I took advantage of that because they were unloading that ship and wasn't anything says that they couldn't drop another one.
That's right. Another
and
some ammo.
My brother-in-law, who was later my brother-in-law, he was stationed there, and his job was to unload ships. And when we were outside of San Francisco one day, the ammunition in the holds, down in the holds, got loose in one of the holds. It wasn't secured good with lumber.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a big pile of projectiles in the middle of the hole.
Mm-hmm.
And on the sides were powdered powder cans. And when that ship would lift like that,
mm-hmm.
those projectiles would go boom, and those powder cans were bent like your elbow.
Ooh.
And
but it hadn't
there's guys down there on their knees praying, I went down and helped them put lumber when they started the list. We'd throw lumber in front of the projectiles and hopefully cushion them up. Well, the skipper came down and said, I'm going to get permission to go on, instead of going this way, we'll go this way, this way, this way. And that made the ship rise this way, but it didn't hurt.
Up and down, frontward and back, but not sideways. Yeah.
And he did, so.
Oh, great.
So, we got into San Francisco Bay, and then they sent us over to Port Chicago, and there they said they were going to pull it out and off the coast there bomb it. It's too dangerous to pull it.
I'll be done.
And they said, but just for a minute, somebody said, let's call in a demolition expert. From, they flew him in from New York, and he got down there and dismantled and defused what he thought ought to be. He said, okay, it should be safe now to unload in a normal sort of way. But first, they were not going to pull it.
They're just going to go sink it, get it out of the way. Yeah, right.
You betcha. And, yeah, I was, of course, I felt sorry for that security officer, cargo security officer. He, they told him we had orders to sail for the United States, and then it was canceled. That wouldn't have happened. I don't know how many times it happened.